Coming up on Tech Nation, our continuing coverage from the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. We're talking about the capabilities of the human brain. How do surgeons become surgeons? And how do they learn new medical technologies? Pediatric orthopedic surgeon Dr. Justin Barad co-founded OsoVR to help surgeons do it better, while another MD, Dr. Daniel Chow, founded Halo Neuroscience to improve any activity requiring repetitive motion training, from athletes to musicians to people recovering from strokes and even surgeons. All this and more coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 minutes.
While my friends on the East Coast and the Midwest are up to their eyeballs in snow and ice, out here in sunny California, there's a new saying: when the sun comes out, so do the wheels. We have stand-up electric scooters and full-on electric bikes, old-fashioned bicycles with new-fashioned bike sharing, both traditional and electric skateboards and larger motor scooters. Anything that will get you from one place to another, and there's an app to share it. What's also happening has been reported in what's called JAMA. That's J-A-M-A, JAMA Network Open. That's one of 12 peer-reviewed journals published by the American Medical Association, and it publishes serious science. And what does the science say in the paper soberly entitled Injuries Associated with Standing Electric Scooter Use? You can guess, can't you? With the electric scooters have come accidents injuring humans, some less serious and some more so. But these were incidents observed over 1 year in a single Southern California emergency room. You can read the study for yourself, and probably should, because we have some hard thinking to do as a society. With the sudden availability of these stand-up electric scooters, ready to be adopted in an instant with an app on your smartphone, we have once again done it first and anticipate learning from it in leisure, especially so if you're on bed rest recovering from an injury. But don't get me wrong. I'm all in favor of them, but I do think we've got to figure out who, where, and when. The answer should be no, you don't get to rent them. I don't know the total number of scooters out there or the societal setting of the medical center itself, but let's just look at the numbers. 249 people presented themselves to the ER with injuries associated with stand-up electric scooters. Over 90% were riders, while something less than 10% were non-riders, presumably having gotten entangled with a scooter. Here's the numbers. 40% had head injuries, about a third had fractures, and a similar number had contusions, sprains, and lacerations. With respect to the subjects themselves, 94% were discharged the same day. 12 out of the 249 people were certifiably intoxicated. 27 patients were under 18, and only 10 patients, that would be 4%, wore a helmet. I'm not sure this is an argument for a helmet law for stand-up electric scooters. The study also counted scooter riders in a local community in a single day. Only 5% wore helmets, and few had problems. So this is the time to think about it. Without being overly cautious here, we can't have non-riders being injured. But these scooters can go up to 15 miles an hour, and that's important to consider. And if you're an adult and you want to ride without a helmet, that's one thing. But what if you're under 18? Now, riding intoxicated, well, come on, there has to be a consequence. And we have no information on the circumstances which brought these people to the ER. One of my students, a college athlete, was hit by a car who didn't see him. There is circumstance to consider as well. So my challenge to you is this. What kind of regulations would be the absolute minimum we need to stop recklessness and keep the wheels rolling? Minimum, I say, not some onerous big blanket regulation that takes all the joy out of riding free. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, in our continuing coverage from the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, we're talking about understanding and tapping into the potential of the human brain. Oso VR's Justin Broad tells us about improving surgical techniques using virtual reality, while Dr. Daniel Chow from Halo Neuroscience introduces neurostimulation to affect any activity involving repetitive motion training. When the occasion arises that we can't avoid surgery, we always want a really good surgeon. But I always wonder, how do they get there? How does a medical student actually become a surgeon? How do we teach people surgery? Justin Barad is a co-founder and CEO of Oso VR.
Yeah, well, it's a process that has existed for 100 years, and it hasn't changed too much in that time. So the pathway to becoming a surgeon, at least here in the U.S., is graduating college and then going to medical school. You spend 2 years in classes, 2 years doing clinical rotations, and then you'll apply and hopefully match at a residency program. And residency program is when you start getting hands-on and patient and gradually start doing more with surgery. So it takes about 5 to 6 years to finish residency. And often people now will add an additional 1 to 2 years afterwards to sub-specialize. And the way residency works is it's a very basic apprenticeship model. So you will spend time with more senior surgeons. You'll help them out in the operating room and clinic. And you'll also take care of a lot of the administrative work. So,
which is why the model has remained in place for many years.
As we can be very helpful. And the data shows that it's an alarming amount of time, really. It's 50% of your time in residency is spent with electronic medical record systems. And another issue, speaking of time away from patients, is we actually had to limit the amount of hours residents were working because they were falling asleep on the way home. And so residents can, I do this with air quotes, only work 80 hours a week now. But they actually, when you do the math, lost about a year of training time with that new work hour implementation. So there's now less time in residency, which is part of the reason why additional years are being tacked on.
So you start and they say, great, everything's all set now. You can close them up, as they say on television. And that might be your part of the surgery to begin with.
Yeah, that's actually absolutely right. We love when that happens as residents because it's, you know, you finally get to do something in the case and you've been standing there for 12 hours, not eating, not going to the bathroom. And it's nice to be able to participate a little bit. So opening and closing a patient will often be some key tasks that junior residents will perform. And as you become more senior, ideally, you'll be allowed to have a bit more autonomy under supervision. The problem is on the residency side that pressures to be more productive as you know costs are becoming tighter, that there is an incentive to finish surgery faster. And while data shows that having residents in the room actually doesn't change the quality of the outcome, so it's not a risk to the patient, but it does slow the case down. So often in service of economics, residents are allowed to do less and less as time goes on. And also as people become more aware of residents, often patients ask us not to touch them or participate in the case in any way, which is totally understandable. But where are we going to get that practice?
Right. So then at some point you walk across this line. and you become a surgeon. How do they test you? How do they certify you're able to be a surgeon?
That's a fantastic question. Actually, they don't. So, and, you know, whether you're applying for residency, whether you are in residency or whether you're out in the world, you're only ever really tested on your knowledge with multiple choice exams. But you're never actually objectively assessed for your surgical skill. The only time I personally was ever really assessed was I was interviewing for a residency program, and they had me play the board game Operation, which apparently I passed that exam, which is good. But this is a great question and really important issue because in the New England Journal of Medicine 2013, there was really a landmark study that showed that, and this is not rocket science, a more skilled surgeon has better results. So those patients will do better. But the problem is that if we're not measuring surgical skill at any point, then we don't know how patients are being affected. And so we can't intervene and provide additional educational resources and training to the people that need it because we don't know that they need it currently.
Well, nevertheless, we know we have surgeons. So there is some way we get from point A where you're just, you know, hopefully opening and closing and having that opportunity to you're actually a practicing surgeon. Now, where I want to go today is as long as you're a practicing surgeon, everything is great. Today, you have many new procedures, many new devices, many new approaches coming down the pike. How do those surgeons learn these new procedures?
That's a great question. So yeah, these surgeons who are graduating from residency, they're coming in already at a handicap because a study in 2017 showed that 30.7% of graduating residents can't operate independently. So you're already starting at kind of a challenging level. And what you want to do as a surgeon is bring the best technology and procedure possible to your patient. And in today's world, with technology the way it is, new things are coming out all the time. And so to learn about a new technology, often it's the technology company that will sponsor our training. That amount of training is relatively limited. So we'll often be flown out to what is called a course, a bioskills course. It's often in a hotel, and there's a cadaver that you practice on once. And these are surgeries when, you know, I'm going to be talking about the orthopedic space, but it's very similar in all the disciplines. These newer surgeries tend to be robotic procedures, image-enhanced procedures, minimally invasive, patient-specific, things that people really want and provide real value, but they're more complicated. So the data shows that you have to do these procedures maybe 100 times before you can do it proficiently. So doing it once in a hotel room is not 100 times. That's one time. And when you're actually doing that procedure on a patient, it's usually on average 4 to 6 months after that one-time experience in a hotel room. So you're there in front of the patient, and this is often the case where, at least when I was a resident, I would often be asked to scrub out and Google what to do, or the rep would be, a sales rep is in the operating room, which is also kind of a really interesting need because these technologies are so complicated, you need an additional person from the company to help you get through the case. And so I'd be looking up YouTube videos, we'd be bumbling around, something would inevitably go wrong. And, you know, that patient was put at risk and everybody was like, we're never using this technology again. It doesn't feel safe. But when in reality, we just didn't have enough opportunities to practice and also assess our readiness to get in there and actually have a patient receive this procedure.
And there are no official rules or regulations that say, this is how you do it. This is how you get more training or more experience, and then we'll let you go do it on your own.
Yeah, it's a little vague and ambiguous right now. The FDA really relies on medical device companies to self-regulate and determine the amount of readiness to perform a procedure, which maximizes the ability to at least get us adequate training resources. But there's not a real standard currently, and so it varies greatly between devices and companies.
Well, you're an orthopedic surgeon, but you're also a biomedical engineer. And when you were young, you were a game developer, at least wanted to be a game developer. No game developer didn't start out as a game player. Big game player?
I have played a game or two, yes.
Which gets us to today and Oso VR. What exactly have you developed here?
Yeah, so what Oso VR is, it's really a combination of my two passions, which is gaming and medicine. And it is a platform that utilizes gaming technology to allow surgeons and surgical trainees to practice procedures in a hands-on, realistic way and also assess their ability to perform those procedures. And it could be used anytime and anywhere and is highly affordable.
And if I just look at it here, it fits in a very small, it's almost like a laptop carry-on. It's just, it's really simple. But you've got standard VR goggles, if you will, that goes over your head, two different game controllers, one for each hand, and that those each have sort of a halo around it, and then sort of peripheral stuff. We're not talking about a lot of technology. What do you see and what do you feel when you're using this device?
Yeah, so when you put on the virtual reality headset, and it's exactly as you described, you are transported to a virtual operating room where you have a patient. You have all of your instruments. In some cases, you have your team members in there with you, and they can be in different countries, and they can participate in the training or the simulated surgery with you.
And they're real. They're not virtual.
And these are real people, and it's very intuitive, and we do have haptic-enabled high fives, which we don't do that often in the operating room, but it's very fun in virtual reality. But once you're
and
in there...
And what's a haptic-enabled high-five?
Yeah, so when you high-five people in Oso VR, you can feel it.
You can feel the hand slapping
yours,
and vice versa.
It's very good for soft skill development, which is important, and we could talk about later. So you have the headset on now, and now you're ready to run through a procedure. And so you will participate with your team, pick up the appropriate devices, and perform the steps of the surgery, and also get tested on certain steps as well to make sure that you're doing them correctly and that you're making the right decisions for the patient given the situation and the specific anatomy that you're operating on. And basically, you go from the beginning of the surgery to the end and then get assessed on your performance and understand where you can improve, whether having a better understanding of the order of operations and the steps that you need to do, whether you need to go a little bit faster, what we like to say surgical efficiency, or whether you need to be a bit more precise. You need to be more accurate with some of your 3D movements and what you're doing, and also how well you worked with your team.
So you're an orthopedic surgeon. Would this be for a knee replacement? What would this be for?
Yeah, knee replacements is one of the areas we definitely specialize in, and there's a very high volume of those and a lot of complex devices in that area. So joint replacement is one of our big focus areas, foot and ankle, orthopedic trauma. We just launched our first pediatric orthopedic module, which I'm a little biased as a pediatric orthopedic surgeon myself, which is really important because that space in particular, the pediatric space, the breadth of what can go wrong in a child is actually much more diverse than an adult. So it can be very hard to stay proficient at these thousands of different things. And so we can provide the opportunity for people to refresh themselves when they are going to do these types of procedures. And it's great that we have the opportunity to also innovate in the space because pediatrics is often overlooked in general when it comes to technology because the markets are smaller and oftentimes the willingness to pay is lower. So, you know, because you can't make a lot of money, a lot of people will just bypass the ped space. So it's always an important part of our mission as a company to democratize education. And so, you know, whether it's attacking a space like pediatrics or bringing our technology across the globe, these are things that we have prioritized.
And pediatrics could mean just smaller, or it could mean it's also a little different.
Yeah, it's both. So obviously you're dealing with some smaller people who are lovely and super fun and cute. But children, and especially in the skeletal system, have a completely different problem set than you and I would have. So the procedures that they would need and the sort of pathology or diseases that you'd be experiencing are totally different than what you see in adults. And there's just much greater diversity of problems that can happen. And the number... It's more controversial in general, so the number of procedures you need to know how to do is much larger because there are multiple solutions to any given problem.
Now, to be clear, we're not taking you from zero to now you can become a surgeon. Basically, you already have to have a lot of the basic surgical training, right?
Yes and no. So yeah. There are certain basic fundamental surgical skills that everybody needs to know that are learned relatively early. So how to use, I'll talk about orthopedics because we use a lot of power tools, like how to use a drill, how to use a saw, understanding dissection and tissue planes and basic surgical technique. Those are still important. It's not necessarily what we focus on. What we focus on is stringing together these surgical skills into a procedure. For us, it's like a surgical skill is a note And a procedure is a piece of beautiful music that is strung together and is quite complex to learn. So we allow people to string together known surgical skills to learn new procedures. Now, I will say yes to that question when it comes to learning a new procedure, because a lot of time is wasted and spent on these steps and the early learning that really is not very efficient use of learning time when a patient is involved. So what you want to do is you want to rapidly accelerate movement along the learning curve to get someone close to proficiency so that when they are doing real world learning, that they already have all the introductory materials down and now they are refining. And there are also complex 3D spatial concepts that we can teach in virtual reality that you can't really teach any other way. So we can give people great understanding of how to handle all sorts of a variety of situations in what we call low frequency, high urgency situations. So we can present someone with rare anatomy or a complication and test them to make sure they know how to get out of these situations, which maybe they'll never see. But when they do, you know that they'll know what to do. And so that's what this technology can do. It can blast someone very far along the learning curve. And we have shown that when you compare someone that's been trained this way to when they did not have access to VR training, the difference is huge. And so people more than doubled in surgical performance in one of the studies we did recently when compared with non-VR individuals. So yes, but definitely as a surgeon, and I want to be clear that real world training is still a critical part of the learning process. But you don't want people jumping in on your mom or dad or yourself at day zero.
Well, you don't want them to fly to Las Vegas, get their one experience in the hotel room or the hotel ballroom, and then 6 months later run into mom or dad and say, okay, here's my next time. I'm all ready to go. And it's like looking at the instructions and what's going on. We've got to get between the time they've gotten their initial real world, which is how we train people in new surgical techniques, and the first real live patient, this is where we can really make a big difference.
And you 100% described it. And one of the pictures we often show people to get that kind of aha moment is we have a picture of a surgery taking place, and there's a large instruction manual unfolded on the patient, and they're like looking at it while they're operating. It's like they're changing the timer on a VCR.
And the truth is, even if you've done 100 of these, we have so many steps. You better be able to check as you're going. You know, you don't want to skip a step. You know, so there's this ability to do checklists, but you're not figuring out how to do the next one. You're not putting together a toy the night before Christmas.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. You know, I think in all sectors, we're starting to understand knowledge and skill attrition. So use Duolingo, for example. If you come back after 6 months of not practicing your Spanish, it knows that now, and so you have to kind of re-get to the level you were at because you just haven't practiced. And this is a huge issue for us. So the other day I was working with a pediatric hand surgeon, and she had an open femur fracture come in, and she was like, I haven't done this in a couple of years. I wish there was a way I could rapidly refresh myself on doing it. I'm definitely proficient in this procedure, but it's been quite a long time, and I'd like to just make sure that I have every single nuance down. And so, yes, that having just-in-time training or the ability to just check and make sure it's like, yes, I do understand all those little details. This is safe for us to proceed would be fantastic.
Well, mothers will even tell you, as the kids were growing up and there were all this thing going on and they're cooking all this stuff and it's really great. And then they get down to, well, we're just cooking for one or two. And then, you know, 5 years later, their kid shows up and says, I really want, you know, what you always cooked. And you're like, I don't even remember what pot I used. And you make it and it's not quite right. And you're like, and it's like, but if you make it a few times, like, now I remember, oh yeah, it needs more of this. And oh yeah, I forgot about this. And you know, it's like, so I don't care who you are and what it is. That's the nature of being human.
And if my mom is listening, it would be ricotta stuffed shells.
So start practicing now, mom. You can do that without VR, without VR. There's a couple of things that I want to ask you about. First and foremost is what you were saying, haptics earlier, so that when you put your hand up to a team member, a real live person, someplace else, you can feel that you've sort of slapped the hand, which I guess is called cutaneous. You've heard of subcutaneous under the skin. This is skin, cutaneous haptics. We actually can experience something like that today with the iPhone.
Yes. So haptics is a really exciting area of new innovation and research, and our understanding is still pretty early, but haptics is divided into different categories. And so one of the categories is something that we're all very familiar with, which is cutaneous haptics, relating to light touch, pressure, and temperature. And we all feel this every day with our phones. So our phone's vibrate function is actually a form of what's called cutaneous haptics. And there's actually a major leap in this technology recently with the introduction of what are called MEMS, microelectromechanical systems. And a great way to just compare this at home for anyone that's listening is comparing an iPhone 6 or much earlier iPhone with an iPhone 7 or 8 or iPhone 10. And you can definitely tell the difference in sort of the feel and the various sort of different feels that can be simulated.
It's not really moving. You think it is.
To the point where even the button press now is not a movable button, but it feels like one. And so this form of haptic feedback has in research been shown to be pretty effective when it comes to surgical simulation and robotics. So in the surgical space, we're really excited about cutaneous haptics. Other areas of haptic feedback that people are excited about would be skin stretch haptics, where actually these mechanical balls, almost like a shiatsu massage, will move your hand and create the sense of weight, inertia, and pressure. And so there's a company called Tactical Haptics that works with this for gaming that's pretty cool. And then also the concept of phantom haptics. So, you know, if people have ever used VR and swear that they felt something, but there's actually no haptic feedback there, that would be an example of phantom haptics, or your brain actually filling in the gaps. I felt this for myself the first time when I used the Da Vinci robot, and I was moving these plastic blocks around with these robotic arms, and I could feel it. I could feel the pressure of holding the blocks. It was amazing. And I turned to the technician for the Da Vinci. I was like, this feels amazing. How did you simulate that sense? And he's like, oh, there's zero haptic feedback on the Da Vinci robot. And so there's actually some early research on this now, and our brains have something called tactile memory. And much like an optical illusion, we'll fill in the gaps and we don't even know what's happening. So a lot of exciting areas around haptic feedback, but these gaming controllers that we use for surgical simulation are quite sophisticated and seem to be very effective, and also from a cost perspective as well.
Well, I just want to point out that our brains are filling in things all the time. You don't need to see more than 18, 20 frames a second, and you're thinking everything's moving. You're seeing a movie. You're actually not seeing anything continuous, but your brain's filling the whole thing in, and it's just great, you know. So the ability of our brains to do and perceive and recall things on many levels are really important to these systems. Now, another area that I wanted to talk to you about was it's not just gee, this seems like a good idea. We can see that there is a benefit. We can measure that, right? You've been studying that.
Yeah, so I went full-time to try and solve this problem within medicine.
I've been speaking with pediatric orthopedic surgeon Dr. Justin Barad, co-founder and CEO of Oso VR. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation are available at NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show, we'll hear from Daniel Chow, the CEO of Halo Neuroscience, about a neurostimulator for repetitive motion training and the science behind why it works. Stay with us. Thank you. You're listening to Tech Nation. I've been speaking with pediatric orthopedic surgeon Dr. Justin Barad, the co-founder and CEO of Oso VR.
I went full-time to try and solve this problem within medicine, which was scary to walk away from a full-time clinical career for something that I spent 14 years preparing for. And so it was really important for me to be like, well, this better work. Because yeah. That wouldn't, that wouldn't be
or
good.
Or no reason. Ricotta-filled shells yeah. for you.
That is a literal conversation I had. Hi, Mom. So one of the first things we did was we tested our technology. So we took participants and we randomized them to two groups. One group was trained with virtual reality to a point of proficiency, and the other group was trained with traditional means. Now, traditional means is we don't have a lot of options. So, text materials, lecture, and everyone was given all the steps and as much assistance as they needed during the procedure. Then we tested them on a real-world version of the procedure, not on a patient, but on what we call sawbones, which is my favorite word, but they're these physical models of bone. And what we found was that when these participants went through and we graded their performance and the person grading them did not know what training they had done, that the group that had trained in VR performed 230% better than the non-VR group, and they were more efficient. So a really very, very large difference in what was an early version of our technology, and it's improved since then. So this definitely works, and we're just trying to get as much out there as possible and simulate as many procedures as possible so that we can make sure that people are performing things at their maximum performance.
Now, for years, decades even, any time you have a simulator, we're talking $500,000, $1 million, $2 million, and things can get better, faster, cheaper, but not that fast, not that well. And I thought, well, we don't usually talk about money on public radio, but I think it's important. How much is this simulator?
Right. So I think that's a great question, because you can have the greatest simulator in the world, and if it's $1 million, not a lot of people are going to be able to use it, and it's not going to provide a whole bunch of value to society. So once again, it's really important for us to democratize surgical simulation. So you can purchase the hardware to run our program eventually for $400 with the new Oculus Quest, but a whole system can cost less than $600 to $700 to run our software. And we're trying to provide it to trainees and surgeons for free. And then we also work with medical device companies and residency programs for a slightly higher cost. But in general, it's about 1% of the cost of the last generation of surgical simulation. So a rather exponential difference.
That game player in you, it's got to cost close to a game.
yeah, which are, they're running for like $1 now.
You'll be like chasing that
the
dollar.
The Clash of Clans of surgical simulation.
There you go. What's also important is you're not sitting in a garage in Palo Alto, California, saying, I hope somebody gets this. This is actually in a number of residency programs now.
Correct. Yeah, we've partnered with a number of the top 10 medical device companies and residency programs, and it's being used globally. So in the Asia Pacific region, in Europe, and here in the U.S. And residency wise, we work with top programs like Columbia, Vanderbilt, UCLA, Hospital for Special Surgery in New York, and many more. And so there's definitely been early on when this was new a couple of years ago when we started. People were not sure that this was the direction that surgical simulation needed to go for a lot of the issues that we discussed, that there were assumptions about the level of realism, the type of haptics, and that a game technology wasn't appropriate. And things have totally flipped. And this is now being seen as a growing standard that we're already integrating into people's curriculum. So when people go on their pediatric rotation, they run through the simulations before they interact with patients. When they go on their joint rotation, the same thing. And so we're already seeing a really rapid adoption. And in an industry, like healthcare is notorious for not changing, right? And so why is that happening? And I think this is a really exciting time in healthcare, not just for education assessment, but for all technology and real opportunity for innovators and people that want to solve problems. And this is why I believe that is. One is the problems are really, really bad. the problems that we're facing that are either happening now or just around the corner are so large that people are like, we need to do something today. So that's one thing. The next thing is that the technology is amazing. The solutions that we have are actually able to solve these problems, which was not the case just a few years ago. And then finally is technology, and thanks to some of the work you're doing, is so a part of our everyday lives at this point. It's not a weird thing. It's something we're all much more comfortable with and willing to try and experiment with. So there's been a real culture shift around how we view technology as a society, especially in a field as conservative as medicine.
If you go back, and it's not that many years ago, if you go back and see what happened with the first Macintosh computer and the first PCs that we had, what really made the difference was not that the people who built the hardware were going to build all the software. And in your case, you've built the simulations yourself, because each one is, if you will, a different VR game, you know. At some point, we're going to get beyond your capability as a pediatric orthopedic surgeon. I don't know how you aren't brain surgery. There's a lot of expertise that is needed here and a lot of ability to develop these games. This is, in that sense, a platform. What is your plan for the development of what's going to be used on this platform?
I think that's one of the best questions I've ever gotten. That is definitely a big, big problem, right? There are so many surgeries, so many variety of patients and anatomy and things that need to be taught. How can OSO VR do it all, right? And so what we are building and what our technology really is the tools to build these simulations. And right now we use them ourselves. And what we can do is we just, in a spreadsheet, we type in, insert screw here, cut this, cut that, whatever, 100, 200 steps, and then we hit a button and suddenly you're given a VR experience and you can run through it. And so we are taking this so that a programmer who is excited about medicine, or even a surgeon or medical device company, can type in these steps and create the procedures themselves so they can start creating their own content, and also creating the quality check systems so that we're like, is this clinically accurate? Is this going to benefit patients? Is this a risk? And then put it onto the platform. So giving people the tools and the platform in order to create and distribute the content is how we plan to tackle that very challenge that you brought up.
Well, Justin, this has been absolutely terrific. I hope you come back to see us again.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. Hope to do it soon.
Dr. Justin Barad is the CEO of OSO VR. More information is available at osovr.com. That's OSO, O-S-S-O, osovr.com. Whenever we talk about our brains on TechNation, we're sticklers to establish credentials. Dr. Daniel Chow is the CEO of Halo Neuroscience. He's an MD out of Stanford Medical School, and he has a master's in neuroscience. So I asked him, what you're telling us about our brains is based on those credentials, right?
For sure. Yeah. Yeah, I don't... It takes a lifetime to build credibility in science, and this is a really important part of me and who I am. So yeah, a lot of homework went into this project before we decided to really put our efforts into this.
What parts of our brain help us to become better athletes, or better ability to do anything physically?
Yeah, so there's different parts of your brain that are involved in this motor system, or this motor circuitry that we talk about in the brain. And there's a variety of different areas, but let me bring up one very important area, because this is very topical for our talk. It's called the motor cortex. So the motor cortex sits in like this U-shape configuration right above our ears, from ear to ear. And this is where the origination of a movement starts. And then from there, it gets passed on to neurons downstream, ultimately ending at our muscles. And that's what leads to movement.
And now let's get over to professional athletes, or athletes that are at, you know, the very top of their game, or people who want to be the best athlete they can. How does that area of the brain relate to their performance?
Yeah, so it has a lot to do with their performance. Their performance of their brain dictates the performance of their movements. So, you know, I think a lot of people falsely think about physicality as being directly proportional and like the key driver to how athletic someone is. But I think they're ignoring at least 50% of the picture. At least the other 50% is the brain. And, you know, there's our local hero. We're both based in the Bay Area, is Steph Curry. And I've met Steph. I've shook his hand. He is only a little bit taller than me and a million times better than me in basketball. So it's not his physicality. There's something else that's really special about Steph that makes him a player of a generation. And I would argue that that thing is that he's a fast learner. I don't think people think about like the performance of the brain and how quickly you can learn during this unique window of time where you're still in your physical prime to get all of that learning done in the first, say, 25 years of your life so that you can use it athletically to become someone, you know, like Steph is today. So, you know, what Steph does, and he's famous for all the practice and shooting 100 three-pointers after every game, so on and so forth, but he's not the only player that does that. There are plenty of other basketball players that practice that much, maybe even more, and yet they're not Steph. So what is it about Steph that makes him great? And I would argue that there's something about his brain. The plasticity of his brain is more robust. And he's able to feed his brain training repetitions that are stickier to his brain more so than other people's brain. And that's what makes him great.
Now, as I recall, part of the reason you practice, even though in Steph's case, he sure does know how to play basketball. We all know that. But while you're practicing and practicing and practicing, when you're in a live situation, you don't have the time to think. So now I want to do this. You need your body sort of to react. You need your brain to be driving it on a less than conscious level, and that it will do what it's supposed to do and you want it to do without you having to consciously think about it. That's what a lot of the training is about. But if you're able to practice for fewer hours, that may be part of what you're talking about with Steph.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, we call, you know, this movement that you master where you don't have to think about it. We call it different things. You know, there's this word muscle memory that probably speaks to this most commonly. So, you know, what is muscle memory? Muscle memory is a movement that you can call upon without really thinking about it. Like we're walking down the street, there's this motor program stored somewhere in our brain that just kind of happens automatically, and you can type and chew gum and do other things. Now, for Steph, he's practiced shooting three-pointers at a level that the world has never seen, and he's able to call on this motor program where, you know, he's got five gigantic guys chasing him down trying to do everything they can to block
the
shot.
The nano window opens, and Steph shoots, and it's 3 points.
He shoots, he scores, yeah. Yeah. I think what we do as amateur athletes or professional athletes, everybody in between, the reason why we train is we're almost begging the brain to commit it to muscle memory, right? There's, you know, this 10,000 hour rule or whatever, but you know, it's like, you know, the concept here is that feed the brain literally thousands of repetitions. And hope that one day it can like that movement is committed to muscle memory. And this is celebrated in culture. It's like, whoa, like so much practice leading to this kind of perfection. But you know, my question as a neuroscientist is like, you know, like what's going on here? Like, how can we optimize this? Like, has anyone ever asked the question, like, why does it take so many reps? You know, why is the 10,000 hour rule the 10,000 hour rule? Like, why can't it be 5 or 2,000 hours? And
why, in my case, is it 30,000?
I somehow doubt that, but so you know, we ask these questions, like, you know, how can we make training more meaningful to the brain, and can we do anything to the brain to make it such that it learns faster?
And now we go back to that area of the brain that you shape sort of from ear to ear on top of your head. that you were describing earlier.
Right. So, you know, we've developed a product. It's a neurostimulator. So it uses electric fields to stimulate the brain. And in this case, the specific part of the brain called the motor cortex. Now, like, what if we stimulate this part of the brain before practice, almost priming this part of the brain so that it's more excitable? Now, if we do this, it turns out that if you feed the brain physical training repetitions while it's in this prime state, it can learn faster. It can accept that information more robustly. It can accept that information at an accelerated rate such that it's committed to muscle memory faster.
Now, you're not just saying that. There's got to be some science here.
Yes. I wouldn't be on your show if that wasn't the case. So, yeah, there's some science. So there's the credit goes to a couple of German scientists where a little over 10 years ago published some seminal papers using this technology called transcranial direct current stimulation, or TDCS. And since that time, you know, we've had, I think, over 4,000 papers published on this topic.
And I hate to say this, but isn't that part of the brain inside my skull? How the heck do they get in there?
Oh, yes. Yeah, so this electric field that we create is strong enough to get through the skull. And that's very smart of you to point that out. The skull is a very powerful resistor, electrical resistor. So, you know, it can't be an electric field that is so weak that it just – that is basically deflected or absorbed by the skull. It needs to be stronger than that. So you can test this experimentally where you can take a group of people and divide them into two, and half get real neurostimulation, the other half get fake neurostimulation that feels like the real thing, but it actually doesn't work, which is awesome because everybody in the study is convinced they're getting the real thing, but only half of them are. You do some baseline testing. You do a bunch of training with real or fake neurostimulation, and then you do some post-testing. And you would fully expect that the control group gets a little bit better because they've done some training, and they do.
And that's the ones with the duds?
That's the one that those people are getting fake neurostimulation. But if neurostimulation is bringing anything to the party, you would expect a lift in performance over the control group with the exact same amount of training repetitions. And that's what we see.
And you're not the only ones that see it.
That's right. Yeah, there's labs around the world that have produced this kind of data. And, you know, I think it's important to mention that the first thing we did as a company is to replicate other people's data, other people's research protocols. Because let's face it, I mean, there's even in the published literature, there's some garbage out there. So, you know, the first thing we did as a company is just like verify the research, and we were able to replicate other people's protocols, which gave us a lot of faith in this technology.
Well, you came in here and I thought, oh, he brings his own, you know, noise canceling headphones from the airplane, and he just has to have them with him at all times. They're like, oh, that's your product. That's the Halo Sport.
Yeah, yeah. It looks like a regular set of headphones. And what your listeners will see is there's the one thing that's different is on the underside of the arch, they'll notice we call them primers, but effectively they're electrodes.
But they look like rubber spikes, like kind of cushy rubber spikes.
Yeah, they look spiky, but
but they're cushy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're actually pretty comfortable.
And that's the part that goes right into on top of your head.
Right.
And on your skull.
That's right. And they have to have the shape that look like little towers so that it can get through hair. Those are the electrodes. And these electrodes are in electrical contact with circuit board that's stuffed into one of the ear cups. And that circuit board talks to an app on your phone, and that's how you control the neurostimulator.
Now, how do you normally use it?
So a typical use case is that you would wear it for 20 minutes, typically paired with your warm-up, right before your workout. And so what 20 minutes of neurostimulation does is it opens up this 60-minute window where you can learn at an accelerated rate. So what we want you to do during those 60 minutes is to feed the brain training repetitions. So if you're a basketball player, practice free throws or three-pointers. If you're a baseball player, practice swinging the bat or golf similarly with a club. If you're a musician, practice the scales that you want to get better at. Practice the Mozart that you want to get better at. If you're a surgeon, practice suturing. Practice the kind of the fine movement that you need to get better at to perform a better surgery. So, you know, I don't want to come off like it's good for everything. The common denominator across everything that I just said is movement training, like repetitive movement training. That's what we can accelerate.
Now, is this a biomedical device? I mean, does it need FDA approval?
Doesn't need FDA approval. So several years ago, the FDA came out with a guidance document that said, hey, we know about this technology. We think it is safe enough to use for companies to market to otherwise healthy people without our approval. So despite TDCS being classified as a medical device, TDCS is a transcranial direct current stimulation.
The same old technology.
The same old technology
earlier with the Germans. Yeah,
that's correct. The technology that is the underlying technology in Halosport that go ahead and sell to consumers, just don't market it towards people with disease. And so, us marketing to athletes and surgeons and musicians, these are, you know, perfectly healthy people that we can market towards.
This is the second version that's come out, you know, pretty quickly on the first. Who's been buying these headsets?
Yeah, so we're known for working with Olympic athletes and professional athletes, but the vast majority of our users are amateurs. So these are runners, cyclists, CrossFit athletes. They're musicians. The military might be our single biggest customer. And they use it for a shooting application. What it really comes down to is just like repetitive practice. Like, how can we accelerate that? On an amateur level, it's those sports.
Now, are there clinical applications?
Yeah. So you mentioned that I'm a doc, and you know, I'm very much I believe that treating disease is still a very big part of why I exist. My last company was a medical device company, and we actually founded Halo as a medical device company. So there's a lot of clinical applications that we're really interested in. So, one clinical trial that we have ongoing right now is looking at stroke rehab. So half of people who suffer from a stroke suffer from some kind of motor disability. You know, some folks can't walk, some people can't use an arm or a hand. And the training for that is actually very athletic. It's movement repetitions. So to the same extent that we can help a football or basketball player with their movement training, like why can't we help a stroke victim with their physical therapy? So we've had a clinical trial that we started about a year and a half ago. And we're looking forward to like continuing with that clinical trial. As you know, these things take a long time, much longer than we want. But yeah, we're really excited about those results. And, you know, hopefully we can provide a solution for people who have had a stroke that are looking to get their life back. So that, you know, that's really exciting to me.
When we have a really new technology, one that we can finally get to the consumer, so many times it's so difficult to figure out who's going to use it for what. We don't know that yet. And I kind of feel like that's where we are.
That's true. Yeah, there's been, we launched the version one of this product 2 years ago. And we were really surprised to see, you know, who ended up buying. So we hardly do any marketing towards musicians. We knew that it would work for musicians, but we purposely decided not to really market towards musicians because we thought it would confuse the world. It's like, wait a second, you're telling me this is great for powerlifting and also playing the violin? Like, how does that work? So we purposely decided with our marketing messaging, to just back off on musicians, and yet it just happened on its own. So that was really cool to see. Also, with surgeon training, I could have never expected that we'd probably have a dozen medical schools that use this for surgeon training now. So that's awesome too. I can kind of go back to my roots and reconnect with medical training, which is awesome.
Well, we never think about that. You know, the surgery is very fine. It's got to be, you've really got to get it right. You don't have a lot of options here.
Right. And, you know, a lot of surgeries these days are not done with our hands. Right. They're done basically with chopsticks through little portholes, like laparoscopic surgery or like basically minimally invasive surgery is done through these little portholes. And sometimes, I mean, it's just not an intuitive movement. And the learning curve is actually, it just takes a while to become an expert in basically doing surgery through chopsticks.
It's interesting that you would say that. I was given a demonstration of a system at UC San Francisco, UCSF, a few years back, in which exactly that was going on. And what we were doing is having nerves severed, putting two nerves together. One comment that came from the creator of this, the doc that was the creator of this, was so many times we are interested in getting into a field that we love, but we don't know whether or not we really are good at it. We know that we're motivated. We know that we'd love to do mm-hmm. this, but we have no tests to figure out how good are we, and have we, and at the end of our career, have we lost our edge? We have no way to really see that or to reinforce what we did to make sure that we're operating at this level. So there are many questions along the way about what these kinds of things can do to help you.
Yeah. Yeah, so like maybe what you're getting at is like, what if you love something but you're not that good at it and you're kind of slow relative to your peers in your growth in like whatever skill you chose? I can think of a couple of folks in like when I was back in college that I genuinely believe that they picked the wrong field for themselves because they were way better at something else and could have achieved greater professional heights if they would have done something else, but they chose what they loved, which they were not that good at. So what if you could pick something that you love that you're not so good at and maybe use neurostimulation to kind of like keep up with the Joneses, keep up with your peer group?
Well, thank you so much. I hope you come back and see us again, Daniel.
I will. Thank you so much.
Dr. Daniel Chow is the co-founder and CEO of Halo Neuroscience. More information is available at haloneuro.com. That's Halo, H-A-L-O, haloneuro.com. From the Consumer Electronics Show, CES 2019 in Las Vegas, Nevada, for Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcore.